This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A tropical storm becomes a Cat 4 Hurricane Helene in 48 hours, the largest monster to ever hit Florida's panhandle. Credit record hot waters in the Gulf of Mexico long after summer has passed. This week's guest, Vandana Shiva, says it is no longer climate change. It is climate havoc. In our second half hour, University of California Distinguished Professor Michael Prather explains methane stays in the atmosphere longer than we were told. Dr. Michael Polanyi on Logging Industry Myths Canada tells the world, more self-delusion on the real emissions driving disruption in the atmosphere. I'm Alex Smith with three interviews. Let's go. If this civilization is suicidal, who will tell us? Do humans have to live this way? Over decades, Indian scholar and activist Vandana Shiva answers. Dr. Shiva trained in atomic research with a Canadian doctorate. She is based in Delhi, but works with groups all over the world. Vandana is an environmental activist, food sovereignty advocate, eco-feminist, and anti-globalization leader. Her core base begins with food, from natural production to healthy bodies and societies. Now Dr. Shiva adds to 20 previous books with a new must-read work called The Nature of Nature, The Metabolic Disorder of Climate Change. From Delhi, India, Vandana Shiva, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
New readers encountering you for the first time might find it a little shocking. Do you think people in developed countries, including some environmentalists, are living in kind of a bubble of self-serving myths?
For sure. The big financing to organized environmental groups, which are different from the movement, has become narrower and narrower and shallower and shallower. And the ecological issues have kind of disappeared to the background, which is why I've written this book, Nature of Nature, to just wake us up to the fact that we are living on a living planet.
And among those myths that you expose in your book are international treaties supposed to protect the environment. You cite the Convention on Biodiversity, but you also talk about the annual COP climate change meetings. We have a lot of climate listeners. Could you tell us how that climate process has been twisted?
So, 92 is when, basically under the pressure of the international movements, which had been people's movements, and our Common Future Report of Gro Harlem Brundtland, commissioned by the United Nations, United Nations meeting was organized at the Rio, called the Earth Summit, and two treaties, legally binding treaties, were created. One was to protect the biodiversity, species, the diversity of this planet, and the obligations of states. Obligations included protecting what they have, recognizing the rights of traditional people. And the clause that I've personally worked very hard on is a clause to regulate GMOs because they have an impact on biodiversity, public health, and livelihoods. The second treaty was the Treaty of the Climate, UN Framework on Climate Change. And originally, both were thought of as interconnected. And it's the South, the so-called developing countries, that really drove both of them. The North was constantly avoiding. Mr. Bush Sr. said, we will not have regulation of biotech because I don't want my industry to lose. But when they see responsibility to the environment and to people as a loss to companies, we've got the wrong model of business and industry. What has happened since 92 is first a separation between the climate treaty and the biodiversity treaty, even though the climate is created by the biosphere and regulated by the biosphere. And there's a big discussion going on in the United States right now on the chronic diseases and metabolic disorders that humans are suffering because of a bad food system. But this book points out that that same bad food system, which is a fossil fuel system, a fossil chemical system, is also leading to the metabolic disasters for the Earth. Climate change should be seen as a metabolic disaster of planet Earth.
The most recent climate conference, COP28, in the United Arab Emirates, was about our climate future, not agriculture. That was its stated purpose. But you say the future of food was also front and center at COP28. How so?
You know, I was invited a few times to the United Arab Emirates because they were preparing for the COP with a focus on food. Of course, it's a desert, not the best place to learn about diversity of life. Yeah, you need to come to countries like India to learn how the desert ecology and the rainforest ecology and the coastal ecologies are all different. COP in the Arab countries turned out to be driving us further and faster down the road of a destructive agriculture model because it's centered on fossil fuels, leading to metabolic diseases of human beings and the climate disaster. Is Mr. Gates. It was the head of an oil agency who was the president. Now, usually, government people who are presidents, never corporate employees, and definitely not the corporations who are at the center of the debate, the fossil fuel industry. And of course, they push a more energy-intensive, more long-distance supply system, which is exactly what has brought us to the crisis. 50% emissions that are accounted for from industrial globalized agriculture. 50%. 14% from production. Another 20% by destroying forests for soybean and palm oil. Another 20% for turning good food into trash, the junk food industry, the processing industry, the food miles, the packaging. And then the waste that comes from a globalized industrialized system, which must be based on uniformity. You know, I wrote a book called Oneness versus 1% because I witnessed Mr. Gates, who's the biggest farmland owner of America today. Most people don't realize it. He started something called Gates Ag One. He wants one agriculture for the whole world and he wants to. So I wrote a book called Oneness versus 1% when I watched the Paris COP being taken over by him. And he did it all over again.
A destabilized climate has burned India this year with long-lasting record heat waves, drought in some places, and unbelievable rains and floods in other parts of the country. Could you tell us about extreme weather in your part of the world?
You see, the Indian subcontinent is on the one hand most beautifully endowed by nature. You know, we've got the third pole of snow in the Himalaya. We've got the deserts of the Thar in the Rajasthan. We've got the rainforests along the western parts. We were the semi-arid tracts in the peninsula. But we are the most affected by climate havoc, even though historically India, not being an industrialized country, is not a historic polluter for whom the original treaty was written. How does climate havoc, I call it climate havoc, I don't call it change, because change lulls you into thinking, oh, a predictable 1 degree increase. No. No, climate havoc is you don't know. One day you'll have heat that is unbearable. The next day you're going to have a hailstorm that will destroy your crop. Same place. It'll be the same place. Unpredictably, no meteorological system is able to predict these extreme events. Extreme events are, of course, intense heat, extended and intense drought, intense rain in very, very short term, which is what's leading to flooding combined with the cementification of the soil, where water has no place to go. And that's why every place is getting flooded. Forest management based on glyphosate and Roundup, for which 1,600 cases are being fought in American courts because it leads to cancer. But they're burning the forest with glyphosate, and it's a desiccant. So the forest will burn, and climate havoc will add to it. So climate havoc is adding to the prior destruction that's being caused to the earth by a mentality of a war against the earth. And so I'm very happy that the COP on biodiversity this year, which will be in Colombia, has been dedicated to the team making peace with the earth. And we all need to make peace with the earth. And having lived in an India pre-globalization, pre-fossil fuels, I can tell you, it's a good life. The fact that fossil fuels bring us civilization is the first step. It just fossilizes our mind into a mechanistic code. It fossilizes our hearts to not have feeling for each other in the earth. And worst.
In harsh honesty, many people in the West concerned about the climate crisis still think climate justice is a wishful add-on. It's something we'd like to work on maybe later after the energy transition. Your thoughts on the role of climate justice, Vandana?
Well, first, you know, in the introduction of my new book, I have mentioned that U.S. is getting polarized around the climate discussion, like it's polarized on everything. Because on the one hand, you have extreme climate deniers, like nothing is happening in the world. We witnessed it. India suffers the worst flooding, the worst cyclones, the long extent. We suffer it. And my learning on climate change is both, of course, following the science, but most importantly, witnessing and living with the experiences. So there's a denialist. But there is the opportunist like the Gates who want to use the climate disaster they have created. 1% is responsible for 60% of the emissions of the planet. They are the ones who should be paying. Polluter pays is another agreement, another principle that came out of the Earth Summit. And yet, Mr. Gates is trying to hijack the whole planet with geoengineering. And for those who say, oh, this conspiracy theory, just read the reports. Read the dimming the sun reports. Read owning the climate reports. The second is genetic engineering in a big way. He has just entered India in a very big way and shifting our agriculture system to do everything wrong. Herbicide resistant basmati. I come from the valley of famous for basmati. And they want to add poisons to it, which gives colon and bladder cancer. What is this insanity? So between these two extremes of the opportunists and the deniers, people working for climate justice are basically saying we need to be fair to the earth. We need to be fair to those who suffer the impact of climate change. And we definitely need accountability for the corporations. I think the big issue now in democracy is accountability for corporations who are destroying both the planet and our health. And they are working, like Bayer has just started to work in America to get laws passed so they have no liability, that no one can make them accountable for the cancer they bring you, that no one can take them to court. This is a system of absolute injustice, the rule of injustice. And so for the Americans, I say, you know, you're an important democracy. Don't hand over your rights to criminal corporations. Defend them from the local to the national level.
Rich countries have research stations in Antarctica, and northern media watch the Arctic, but there is widespread ignorance of disappearing ice in the Himalayas. What should we know about climate change and the Third Pole? And I know you wrote a book about this about 15 years ago, but it's ongoing. Tell us about it, please.
Yeah. So, you know, before the Copenhagen summit, which is when the legally binding treaty was killed, and Paris was merely a gathering of volunteer commitments, it wasn't, you know, laws are supposed to be legally binding. We did both research, deep research, with the top climatologists, with the top glaciologists, but with local communities who know this glacier used to be 25 meters thick and now it's 1 meter. Because from the ground, you get the witnesses. Right now, the people of Ladakh who live only on glaciers because it's a high altitude desert, they have no rain. It's the glaciers that melt and give them the little bit of water with which they grow their food. They're on a march all the way from Ladakh, from the top, the Indian map, to Delhi. They're walking. They're walking for climate justice and waking the world up to the climate disaster at the Third Pole because glaciers are disappearing. In other places, glaciers are melting. In 2013, we had a disaster in my region where the glacier melted. And along the valley, they're building dam on dam on dam, excavating the mountains. The combination of dam building and the ruins from dam building and the glacial flood and heavy rains added up to a disaster that killed 20,000 people. They just got washed away. Schools got washed away. Bridges got washed away. We had to build little bridges for the students to be able to walk across. Otherwise, they were walking 8 miles and not being able to attend school. So climate disasters in the Third Pole. A, the Third Pole is an inhabited pole. There are people here. Second, it supplies water to half of humanity. Half of humanity gets its water from the Himalaya. And we're destroying this water source that nature has given us by being irresponsible to the earth and her climate system.
So do you think the climate science, as it's now constituted and as it's used by bodies like the IPCC, is it a tool still for domination of women, people of color, and of nature? What do you think?
Well, you know, so-called climate science, most of it is built on a lot of modeling. And modeling are good add-ups to real experience. And to me, real science comes from knowing how systems are working and living systems are working. So living systems are still missing. Gaia is a living planet. Gaia is Mother Earth. The living systems and their living laws are missing. It's the climate discussion overall, and the media has a role in it, has reduced the complex disturbances to the Earth to one indicator alone. You know, when you are fatally sick, of course your temperature goes crazy, but so does your hydrological balance. People die of dehydration long before. They don't die of temperature increase. They die of dehydration. When we are not looking at water, we are not looking at the destabilization of water systems, of ocean systems, of rainfall systems. India lives on the monsoons. Now we are on the 26th of September. We shouldn't be having rain. All of last night and all of today, it's been raining. The monsoon should be over. The havoc in the monsoon is causing problems because now our harvest is ready. We don't want rain. We want good sun. So people should be looking at the third pole. And our report on climate change at the third pole, as well as a short film on the third pole, on what a disaster means in the high Himalaya, in the Ladakh region.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. From Delhi, Alex is talking with author and activist Vandana Shiva.
Let's get to one of your specialties, the food chain. What do you mean by dead food, and why is that connected to a dead metabolism?
Both in Western medicine, Greece, Hippocrates, he said, let food be thy medicine. And in Indian Ayurvedic systems, the oldest system of healthcare, it says, annam shorav sarva oshadi, food is the best medicine. So food is living, it comes from living soil and plants that are living, and then it goes to our gut. Our gut microbiome is living, it's called our second brain, 100 trillion microbes in our gut. 90% of us is microbes. We are not human cells. And living food enriches every part of this linkage. It enriches the soil and regenerates the soil. And in Navdanya, the movement I founded, we measure. Every 10 years, we measure. And soil fertility is going up where we are taking care of the earth, and it's going down. It's being desertified where chemicals are being used. And when the soil has been destroyed, then the plants are empty of nutrition. And it's the nourishment that matters, not the weight. Weight of food is not a good indicator, very Cartesian. What matters is what's in it, what's the quality. And the living quality then nourishes all our gut microbiome. But if we kill the soil and the plant is nutritionally empty, we are starving our gut microbiome. And then we start to get all kinds of metabolic disorders because food is what runs the metabolism. For me, dead food is food that kills the living systems that are supposed to be producing it, and therefore comes into our body as not just the absence of living food, but as dead food, which is also toxic. And that's where all of the metabolic disorder. Earlier, they used to talk about every part of the body being different, the mechanistic ideal. But they used to talk about heart problems and diabetes and everything is separate. Now, doctor after doctor is saying it's all one metabolic disorder and it's linked to the food we are eating. And I call it dead food, junk food. You can give it many names. You can create a very colorful vocabulary about how we are killing the earth and our food and our bodies.
You are a world-recognized voice for a vegetarian diet and animal rights. Now Bill Gates, who you've mentioned, is funding production of meat cultured in labs so no animals to suffer. Is that the right direction?
I'm a vegetarian because I don't like the taste and smell of meat. So, making GM soya into a fake Impossible Burger is still undesirable food for me. And I cannot understand how people who don't like meat want to pretend they're eating meat. Why are they fooling themselves? Second, new studies have shown, of course, Bill Gates does everything in the pretense of the climate. And he speaks nonsense. I have to say, he speaks nonsense. He says, planting trees which engage in photosynthesis, idiots do that. I build big machines for absorbing the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And then he talks about cows as methane emitters because they have four stomachs. Four stomachs are designed for eating roughage. The herbivores eat herbs. They're not meant to eat soya bean. And the problem is the factory farming. The problem is not the cows. It's how we treat the cows. And research has now shown that cows are part of a biogenic cycle. In 10 years, the little bit of methane they emit is reabsorbed, becomes carbon dioxide, becomes grass, becomes their fodder. But further research is showing that this pretense of lab food as a solution to climate change is just bad science. It'll need 5 times more acreage for feedstock to feed those microbes in the lab. Just like when they put factory farming, they said, oh, we use so little area for the animals. But they forgot that they use huge acreages for the animal feed. So the feedstock is what matters, 5 times more. And worse, because here's the sun giving us free energy, but not just free energy, then the living systems are creating food for us through what Schrödinger called a negative entropy system. No emissions, no pollution. And by putting microbes in labs to pretend to make your food and then bringing energy from outside, you will have 25 times more emissions than the current system, which has already brought us to the disasters we are facing. So sadly, Mr. Gates used dishonest means to make money, and now he wants to use even more dishonest means to destroy a vulnerable planet and fool the people. And we've written books on him. We call him a philanthrocapitalist. He gives little bits of money, dangles little bits of money, and then takes over entire systems, the entire health system, the entire media, the entire agriculture and food system. He doesn't have knowledge, nor does he have compassion. And those are two other qualities that a good food system needs.
I wonder if we can assign so many evils of industrial civilization to the 1%. I mean, Karl Marx believed that those at the top are just as deluded as those at the bottom. We know Jeff Bezos does not become a multi-billionaire or Gautam Adani without millions of customers buying products, participating in this nature-wrecking machine. Who are the 1%, and does that give the rest of us a pass?
You know, 1% is just easy number than to write by 0001%. Actually, it's just a handful. The last time the Oxfam did a study, they talked about 12 people. And I used to say, well, you know, some of them want to escape to Mars. Let them just get into a spaceship and go and leave this beautiful Earth to us. And when you say, are we free? Well, when a farmer is forced by a Monsanto and now a Bayer to buy GMO seed because they deliberately destroy the alternative, or a poor person in an inner city is forced to go to a 7-Eleven to buy dog food and junk food to eat, because they've destroyed the food system, you can't blame the people in the food deserts. You cannot blame the Indian farmers who committed suicide because they were locked into debt because of high-cost GM seeds. These systems are the 1% who extract rental economy. They are not producers. They rent. They collect rents. They are not just collecting rents. They are working in very devious way to destroy alternatives so that people are left with no choices. And that lack of choice is the death of economic democracy.
I recently spoke with Philippe Sieyès from the Institut Pierre Simon Laplace in France. He told us human interference is turning the plant world from a carbon sink that holds some of our emissions to a carbon source. That means we can't save a livable climate without saving natural systems. You have been saying that loudly for years in books and speeches all over the world. Why don't we get it?
We don't get it because most people have been, you know, separated from the process of nature. And then the fake science, the fake mechanistic science. Tell me how many young children learn that at the end of the day, it's the sun's energy, the miracle of photosynthesis, on which Einstein wrote his first paper, you know, and defined the photon and the photoelectric effect. But these are processes. The sun's energy and photosynthesis gives us our food, our fiber, everything. I have come to it by both building systems, beginning with saving the seed to break the monopoly. We've saved 4,000 varieties of seeds. We've created 150 community seed banks because I'm committed to defending the commons. But through those commons, we regenerate the earth. And the more intense in biological and ecological terms of farming is more photosynthesis, more biodiversity. We get more nutrition, we get more food, and we address the climate problem. All of these problems are interrelated. Why don't people get it? Because we have been colonized by the mechanistic mind. With the Bacon saying, we've got to torture nature, we've got to make her the slave, and we have to use a tortured nature to build a big empire over the earth, an empire over lesser creatures. When we see our relatives at the trees, when we see the microbes, which are such important players in the web of life and in the food web, and we see them as subjects to be conquered and then exterminated, people will not recognize that the biosphere is vital to address the climate problem. And the food issue, being part of the biosphere, is central to both creating healthy communities and societies and a planet that sustains itself in us.
I'll bet you are involved in a dozen projects right now. Where will you put your focus this year?
Well, our focus will continue to be seed sovereignty for the farmers. And wherever our farmers have saved seed, no one is in debt. No one is committing suicide. Food sovereignty, A, to be able to choose their seeds and to be able to grow the foods that are right for their climate and for their food culture, but also don't need external inputs of fossil fuels and fossil chemicals. All chemicals in agriculture are fossil chemicals. For the movements that are very alert on fighting fossil fuels, you need to get involved in resisting fossil fuels in the form of agrochemicals, which are poisoning our food system. But this year, we're going to focus now on saying, on basically the people are the victims of the climate havoc. And I'm working with communities. Women are anyway are the best reports to tell us what a flood meant. They tell us what a drought meant when they were about to plant. And so we're going to equip them with little bits, you know, of a rain gauge and hygrometers and thermometers so that they can be their own monitors, not just in experience, but also in collecting data. And then from the grassroots up, we tell the climate story, not just on terms of the impact on people who never drove the climate havoc, but also in terms of strategies for resilience. You know, the seeds we've saved, many of them have climate resilience. Mr. Gates just today has posted, oh, only I can invent climate resilience. No, you're stealing the seeds our farmers have already done on salt tolerance and salinity tolerance, on flood tolerance and drought tolerance. You've been a pirate from the beginning in software. Now you want to be a pirate of the wealth of the earth? No. We will protect this beautiful earth, but we will do it with people's participation. And I think this epistemological apartheid that was created, that there's experts and there's stupid people on this planet, it must go if we got to address the climate problem or all other ecological problems and all of the economic problems. I learned when I was involved with the Chipko movement up in the high Himalaya, that the women knew so much. I said, I'm doing a PhD, and they know every plant. They're experts without going to university. So we're going to tell the climate story of expertise from the ground, that there are experts everywhere. Everyone is a knowledgeable person. Every citizen, every worker, every child. We need to get out of ecological apartheid, that we are separate from nature, and epistemological apartheid, that a few billionaires can just steal the right of deciding what's knowledge and what's not knowledge, what's science and what's not. I think that epistemological apartheid is the death of knowing intelligent people and the recognition of knowing intelligent plants, microbes, animals. The life is intelligence. Autopoiesis is intelligence.
You've put a smile on my face. From Delhi, India, we've been speaking with renowned author, activist, and educator Dr. Vandana Shiva. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Look for her new book, The Nature of Nature, available in mid-October. Vandana, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up, why methane is hanging in the sky longer, and the myths of carbon neutral logging.
Now this week, scientists examined the temperatures in the North Caribbean and Eastern Gulf of Mexico and found that they were 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit higher than normal. And human-caused climate change made these temperatures 200 times more likely.
Marina Jurica, CBS News.
EcoShock Radio, for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You know, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere causes global warming. But methane and nitrous oxide are more powerful warming gases. They are increasing as methane pours out from gas fracking, leaky pipelines, and industry. Natural methane production by tropical bogs and thawing permafrost add even more, as Earth heats up. But it's a short-lived gas, right? Maybe not.
Humans change the atmosphere, a part of Earth that's pretty hard to study. Atmospheric scientists specialize in this research, and among the leaders is Dr. Michael J. Prather. With a long history of publications, Michael is Distinguished Professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. Prather and co-author Li Zhu just found the dangerous warming gas methane can last longer in the atmosphere than we thought. Models and climate expectations may need to be changed. From Irvine, California, Michael Prather, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to join you.
So we have a carbon tracker, and people pay a lot of attention to carbon dioxide, but methane is not really a climate celebrity. How much does methane in the atmosphere drive the extreme warming that we've experienced in recent decades?
Methane has always been the number two greenhouse gas. Of course, being the number two child, you always get left behind on things. But basically, methane by itself is about a third as much as CO2, but it also changes ozone and water vapor in the stratosphere, which adds about another third. So the methane impact for the concentration we're looking at now is about 60% that of the CO2 increase.
That's pretty big. So, according to the World Meteorological Organization, methane, or CH4, has a relatively short lifespan in the atmosphere, lasting, 8 to 10 years. Robert Howarth of Cornell warned methane lasts much longer. Would you care to weigh in?
Methane, we sort of know what happens to it in the atmosphere because we know the reactions. The loss rate of methane is highly variable, and we've done a lot of studies, both aircraft and other studies and modeling studies, try to understand the variability of methane and its loss. Generally, I would say we have a number that sits between 8 and 12 years. It's hard to imagine living much longer. Now, that's an estimate of the E-fold time, sort of the decay rate, which would be a standard exponential decay, which would be 1 over 2.8 every 8 to 12 years. So it's not a half-life, but it's an E-fold time. And that's pretty well known. We have various ways of calibrating it, but there's an uncertainty range of, as you see, about 50% in that, 30-50%, that we are not sure of. And that makes a difference when you're trying to plan ahead or trying to understand if you can reduce methane by a certain amount, how much impact that will have.
Well, we just lost your co-author, Dr. Zhu, in Albany, but I want to ask, why did you and she undertake this new study?
Right, so Lin Zhu and I met several times at the HU in scientific meetings, and she works a lot on laboratory measurements and was doing an extremely difficult measurement, which was the ultraviolet absorption of water vapor and the ultraviolet that reaches the surface of the Earth. And so she had gone through very hard-knocked life of pushing the instrument to the limit and trying to measure the absorption. People before had measured it and found it to be insignificant. And she found that it was significant at some level, and she could detect it. And so we used to talk at the meetings, and so I got interested, so I took her results and put them into a model that we have in UCI, and it would allow the water vapor to absorb and change the radiation field in the lower atmosphere. And we found it reduced the ultraviolet by about 10% near the surface, where most of the methane is lost in the lower atmosphere. And therefore, it ended up changing the lifetime methane about 4-5%, which meant that we reduced it, which means methane was then longer lived by that amount. And so it's still, this is all within the uncertainties we have, but it's a systematic offset. So you're looking at a scientific thing, which we've we trust those measurements, then we have a significant offset in the lifetime. And now we're looking at, again, you know, 5% or so shift in how we model the lifetime and the loss of methane.
Well, 5% of something that is so widespread in the atmosphere is a significant amount. Now, could you please introduce us to the key player in some ways, the hydroxyl radical, and why they matter?
Okay. So normally our atmosphere is driven by photolysis of ozone in the ultraviolet. And so that's at wavelengths less than 320 nanometers, which is fairly small. You don't see, your eyeball can't see it. It's the kind of sunlight that causes erythema, basically sunburn, and also skin cancer. And so we have the ozone layer to protect us from it in the stratosphere. And what this is doing is it's adding more protection because water vapor, which is prevalent throughout the lower atmosphere, it's humidity, you know, it's basically what we feel in the steamy weather, that now absorbs in the ultraviolet in addition to ozone. So there's another gaseous, you know, species in the atmosphere that takes up the sunlight in this critical region. And this region is where the region where when you photolyze ozone, you make very highly energetic, basically stable atomic atoms, O single D, semi-stable, that reacts with water vapor. So water vapor and the ozone photolysis product drive the hydroxyl radical. And hydroxyl radical cleans up methane as well as many other pollutants. So we've not only made methane live longer, but we've also reduced the ability to clean up other pollution in the atmosphere.
Okay. And also, we know the warmer atmosphere will hold more water. Could a wetter atmosphere further increase the lifetime of methane, or does that matter?
It will. The question is how much. We know that water vapor increases about 7% per degree. And so if we say that we're going to be warming to 4 degrees Celsius, which is a lot, which would be really bad for climate, we get about a 30% increase in this effect. And so it would enhance the problem, and it would, say, drive it from, say, 5% to 6%, or 4% to 5%. So a warmer, wetter atmosphere, which we expect in future climates, will enhance this effect, but it will enhance it at a level that is, you know, worrisome and important, but not stunning. It's not going to double it. It would increase it by maybe 10 to 30%.
Now, in the 1800s, Irish physicist John Tyndall captured air in glass flasks and discovered carbon dioxide warms the atmosphere. How did you and Dr. Zhu study methane gas chemistry in the atmosphere? What are your tools?
Okay, so my tools are basically a photochemistry model that I built in various pieces. It includes putting together all the physics we know of the trace gases, their laboratory measurements, atmospheric measurements of how much ozone is out there in the first place and how the sunlight goes through it, measurements of the solar spectrum from space and from balloons. And so we put together those into a physics model. And Dr. Lei Zhu was the one who had the laboratory instrument. So she worked very hard to measure, to put water vapor in a test cell and try to measure the absorption. And that's a really tough measurement because it's a very, very low cross-section. But there's so much water vapor in the atmosphere compared to any other species. I mean, water vapor in our atmosphere, the reason why it's important, is like oxygen. Oxygen is 21%. Water vapor in the lower atmosphere is 1 to 2%. Okay, so it's one of the major species. And so even with very, very, very small cross-sections, it has quite a large effect.
In our email exchange, I asked how much extra warming is implied by your new understanding of methane in the atmosphere, and your answer surprised me, none. And I read your 2012 paper, Reactive Greenhouse Gas Scenarios. I admit, I still don't get it. If methane lasts longer than previous models showed, why doesn't that add more warming?
Okay. It does sound nonsense, doesn't it? The funny part is that what we use to calculate how long methane lasts in the atmosphere is basically a calibration against measurements of other trace gases that we know about. And we use the models to figure out how that might change with climate and with other gas emissions, but we don't take the current absolute value from the models and use it. Why? Because we think it's always been too fast removal. So the actual numbers that IPCC uses to estimate impact of methane on future atmospheres is actually calibrated against other observations of trace gases that we scale to get the lifetime of methane. So what the new work did was show that the models, which always had methane being lost too quickly, can now approach the observations that had other trace gases that indicated that methane was actually being lost more slowly. And so they never really trusted the models. I mean, that's what I live by, building models, trying to understand them. But effectively, we agreed that the best way to understand methane was to scale it to other trace gases.
So you'd already sort of adjusted for this possibility.
Well, what we have, what the still work does, the reason why it was of interest to science, however, is that the models had always had methane being destroyed too quickly. And we said, no, we think the scaling to other trace gases is more accurate. So we've used that in IPCC assessments since 1990. So what this does is it says, oh, maybe the models are not as far off as we thought they were. So it pushes the models closer to the answer we get from scaling.
I get it. Now, is it fair to say that humans didn't just change the atmosphere? Have we destabilized it?
Ooh. When we were first looking at methane and chemical feedback, because methane has a feedback on its own lifetime, we were looking at instability and whether or not we put enough junk in the atmosphere, it would lose the ability to clean itself. So there was this issue about runaway methane growth in the 1990s. And when you build simple models, you can always get conditions under which it had the runaway growth. But as we built more and more sophisticated or more detailed models, not just sophistry, more detailed models with more chemistry, we found out that we were nowhere near a methane runaway growth that was originally proposed in the 1990s. Because there's enough degree of freedom, there's enough activity going on in the atmosphere that increasing methane will add to the enhancement methane, but we're far away from an instability in the chemistry.
You worked with NASA on aircraft exploration of atmospheric processes. What is the state of play for that program, and what do you hope it achieves?
Well, the program that I worked with, I've worked on many NASA aircraft programs in various ways. When I was at NASA, I worked on designing them. As a university professor, I worked on using them to understand the models. And recently, I helped design one did a lot of surveying to go after the methane lifetime and the methane loss in the atmosphere in high detail. And looking at sort of like bits and pieces, parcel by parcel, the variability throughout the atmosphere. That one came up with some pretty good stuff, and we now begin to understand the variability and where methane is lost, and we have good tests now for the models. That effort ended in 2019. It was called the Atmospheric Tomography Mission, ATOM. And right now it's open to be reproposed, but NASA... It's just two good news and bad news. NASA finally had to shut down the DC-8 aircraft, which enabled it. It was a huge old DC-8 filled with instruments and people flying up and down the Atlantic and Pacific. But NASA has just acquired and is now rebuilding, take another year or two before it can fly, a 777 aircraft, which will have twice the capacity and twice the distance of the DC-8. And so it opened up another opportunity, shall we say, for measuring the remote atmosphere and sampling it. The advantage of the aircraft is you fly through it and you measure every air parcel, you measure the full composition, you know, every few seconds. And this gives you a sort of a sample that's only, it's about maybe 100 meters long by 10 meters thick. So you're measuring those sort of the individual air parcels. And so then you can add up all the statistics. It gives you a view of the complexity of the atmosphere, the extremely reactive parcels, the sort of parcels that aren't doing anything. And it allows you to sum over a wide range. For example, the methane loss in the parcels we measured varies from effectively several parts per million per day to, in some parcels, to almost nothing, like 0.01. And so some parts of the atmosphere are really reactive, and they're really important to understand, and other parts, it really doesn't matter what you do there. So it's an interesting task of sort of going through the heterogeneity of the atmosphere with the aircraft, which has been quite instructive.
And I wouldn't have imagined it that way. I thought it was all sort of evenly spread out among the gases, but you're saying there's sort of pockets and regions of it?
Well, methane is mostly spread out, except air emissions, but the reactivity that destroys it is quite heterogeneous. It's got hot pockets, it's got cold pockets. Thus, if you look at methane, because it has a lifetime of about 10 years, it's pretty well mixed. It'll be variable at maybe 5%. You'll see variations at 5%, 8%, 10% around the globe. But the loss of methane, you'll see variations of a factor of 100 between some parts of the atmosphere which are not doing anything and other parts which are highly reactive. And that's because of all the small, highly reactive trace gases that have sources and sinks. For example, nitrogen oxides made from lightning over the globe are highly important, but they are very localized, and they last for a while, and sort of you have intense regions of chemical reactivity.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I think science is progressing, and we keep learning more and more. Some of the things we learn make us worry because it means we may not understand what's really going on, but most of the time, we tend to improve it, like this water vapor absorption that Lei Zhu and I found from working at Health in Albany. This stuff is sort of like one last thing sitting out there that we may have forgotten. And so it's like tightening things up and getting more and more confident in your projections. So I would say in terms of understanding methane and this and other projects that people are working on, they're quite amazing, especially on emission patterns and location of the natural sources, are really very important to understanding this important greenhouse gas.
From the University of California, Irvine, we've been speaking with distinguished professor Michael J. Prather. His work has been fundamental to understanding the atmosphere, and he's also been a leader in organizing science to study it. Find links to find out more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Michael, thank you for taking the time to talk with our listeners.
Alex, so glad to join you this afternoon. Thanks a lot.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
For years, governments and experts told us forests are like sponges soaking up our carbon waste. Even if you log them, the new green growth will suck up more carbon. But more honest reporting reveals logging leaking more greenhouse gases than they recapture. Canada has about 9% of all forests, third biggest behind Russia and Brazil. The Canadian government pushed that myth of forest sinks and neutral logging for decades. They recently came more clean, but of course not really clean. Our future climate could hang in the balance. This is big stuff. According to a new report released September 2024, logging emerges as Canada's third largest climate polluter. Lead author is Dr. Michael Polanyi, Policy and Campaign Manager for the Nature-Based Climate Solutions at Nature Canada, which is a nonprofit conservation group. From Ottawa, Canada, Michael Polanyi, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Good to be with you.
Before this year, what was the government of Canada telling the world about greenhouse gas emissions from their giant logging industry?
Nature Canada has been talking with officials from Environment Canada and Natural Resources Canada, raising concern that they aren't transparently and separately reporting greenhouse gas emissions from logging in Canada. If one looks at the government's emission reduction plan, you see pretty clearly what the emissions are for most economic sectors, whether it's agriculture or oil and gas or transportation, but it's impossible in that document to know what are the greenhouse gas emissions that Canada's large logging industry is responsible for. So really, the problem is that Canada is not separately and transparently telling Canadians what the greenhouse gas emissions are associated with logging, and that makes it very difficult to put in place policies to address the emissions from that sector.
About 46,000 Canadians work in logging. Many of my neighbors do. Before these new admissions, was the government just sort of hiding this, or did new science reveal this increase in emissions because of logging?
Well, what the Canadian government reports is what they call combined net flux from forest land, including harvested wood products. And that's a bit of a mouthful. It's what they're talking about there is they report the net carbon emissions from all of forested land that's in the managed forest. And that number is roughly carbon neutral. And the problem with reporting that is the government is crediting the logging industry with a massive carbon sink that the industry really has done nothing to create. So this is a carbon sink that's created by trees regrowing naturally after wildfires. And even though Canada does not count the emissions from wildfires because they deem those to be natural, they do take credit for, in 2022, about 130 megatons of carbon sequestration that occurs after wildfires by trees that are naturally regrowing. So this is a bit complicated, but the bottom line is that Canada is really masking the true carbon footprint of logging by basically giving the logging sector credit for work that's being done by Mother Nature.
Well, and we're sort of masking the true additions of greenhouse gases by Canada when we report to world bodies and to the rest of the world.
Well, exactly. I mean, our study found that logging emissions in 2022 were 147 megatons, and that makes logging the third highest emitting sector in the Canadian economy after oil and gas and transportation. And that's 147 megatons is about 20% of Canada's total reported emissions. So the problem is that Canada has an emission reduction plan, which is ignoring one-fifth of the emissions from its economy. And it's putting in place policies that are based on a kind of false picture of industrial logging as being carbon neutral. So often in policymaking at the federal and provincial level, forestry is portrayed as a low carbon sector, a sector that is a potential carbon or climate solution, when in fact it's one of the biggest emitting sectors in the Canadian economy.
So let's break this down. A whole valley or mountain of trees is cut down. Where does the new carbon into the atmosphere come from?
What it involves is taking the total carbon that is removed from the forest during the logging process. So some of that carbon is from the soil that's disturbed. Some of it's from wood that's actually removed from the forest. And some of it's just wood waste that decays on the forest floor. So taking that amount of carbon, and it's a massive amount of carbon, and then subtracting the amount of carbon that's sequestered, that's pulled out of the atmosphere by trees that are replanted by logging companies after they've logged forests, giving them credit for that. And then also subtracting or giving credit for carbon in wood that's stored over decades in long-lived wood products like construction materials, 2x4s, furniture, other wood products that keep the carbon out of the atmosphere for decades. So that's really how we calculated the net logging emissions in Canada.
And totally missing in too many discussions, tell us how soils exposed and disturbed by logging leak out greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
I mean, in the boreal forest is a huge store of carbon. Canada's boreal forest is, as people probably know, is a massive area. It stores about twice as much carbon as all the known oil reserves in the world. And a lot of the carbon in the boreal is stored in the soil. And much of logging in Canada is conducted through clear cutting. And when there's a clear cutting that takes place of a forest, a massive amount of soil is disturbed, and that causes the carbon to be released into the atmosphere. Researchers like Dr. Suzanne Simard at the University of British Columbia have explored this and have raised concern that Canada's modeling of the impacts of forestry and logging doesn't fully take into account the carbon dynamics from soils, the carbon loss from soils. And I think researchers have indicated that, you know, even if a forest is replanted with saplings, which do grow fairly quickly and start to absorb carbon, you know, fairly quickly, it takes decades, if not more than 100 years, for those regrowing saplings to balance off the massive amount of carbon that's lost during the clear cutting process.
Can the Canadian logging industry significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or does real climate action simply mean logging less and preserving more forests?
So I think the question is, you know, what are some ways that Canada's logging industry can reduce the emissions associated with logging? And I mean, I think what we have suggested and is also suggested in the peer-reviewed paper by David Bysouth and co-authors is, you know, thinking carefully about where we log, thinking about how we log, and thinking about what we use harvested wood for. So in brief, yes, likely there will need to be a shift in logging away from the most carbon-rich forests. So away from old growth forests and primary forests, which are forests that have never been logged before, towards secondary forests. So harvesting forests that have been replanted rather than expanding into primary forests, which store so much carbon, which is so important in terms of fighting climate change. Secondly is shifting away from clear cutting. It's not totally clear what percentage of logging is by clear cutting, but it seems like, you know, roughly 60 to 70% is. So that's based on, you know, government databases. So moving away from clear cut logging towards more selective logging, which means taking some trees out of the forest, but not clearing all trees and disturbing the soil as much as is done through clear cut logging. And then the third is just making sure that as much as possible, when we are harvesting logs, we're using those logs for long-lived products, which I talked about before. So for wood materials, construction materials, that sort of thing. Rather than using logs for wood pellets that are burnt and emit carbon immediately into the atmosphere, or short-lived products like tissue paper and toilet paper. So as much as possible, making sure that we're keeping the carbon out of the atmosphere. And that's going to help economically as well, because long-lived wood products have more value added. They're more likely to create jobs than short-lived products.
You can find the 2024 logging emissions update at the website naturecanada.ca. We've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Michael Polanyi. Michael, thank you for your work and talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex, so much for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Reporting from the Climate Battle Zone, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Increasing intensity of hurricanes is basically rooted in physics. It's the physics of our entire climate system. So hurricanes draw energy from that warm ocean water. And as that climate change causes sea surface temperatures to rise, the energy available for these storms increases. In fact, we estimate that the world's oceans have absorbed over 90% of the excessive heat that's caused by greenhouse gas emissions. Now, this added heat is fuel for hurricanes, making them more powerful.